K2LAW testing. Okay. At this time, we begin the TechNet on Lime Rock. K2 Romeo India Whiskey. My name is Dick, and along with Mel, K2 KEY. This thing called TechNet usually takes place Sunday night, 8 o'clock. The main purpose of that is education. There's lots of complicated things going on in ham radio. And for those who are curious enough to want to know about it, quite often you'll find out here. Good group of people gather that have all kinds of knowledge and they're willing to share it. That's the main characteristic of ham radio. They love to share information with each other. A person signs into the TechNet because they have a question or a comment by giving Mel and Dick your call letters, your name, and a confirming yes. A typical sign-in would sound like this, N2EO, Rich, and yes. So do we have any check-ins? Give me your call letters and name at this time. K2LAW listening.
N2EO, Rich, and yes.
I'll speak to QGZ, Bill, yes.
M2MLC now.
And Paul with the Science Space Report.
Good evening, all. This is K2KTY.
M2MLC now. I think I may have doubled.
Okay, so far we've got Rich, Bill, Mel number one, Mel number two, and Paul. Anyone else?
KP2SRV standing by, first time, just one of the listeners.
And Mr. SRV, what is your handle?
First principle's Luke, KP2SRV.
Luke? Like Luke Skywalker. Okay. Anyone else check in? Give me your call letters and name at this time. Okay, I guess it was M-O-C, Mike. I thought it was Luke. I mean, Mel. So M-O-C is Mike, and we've got you. Anyone else?
K-2-K-N-D. Rich, just listed.
El Presidente. Thank you, sir. Okay. More than enough to get started. Let's see what's happening in Whitestone. Rich, N-2-E-O, you've got it.
Okay, Jake, good evening, and Romeo. First time I got my voice back, pretty much. And it looks like I walked out. I haven't done anything really, but just thinking about doing some more work on my homebrew, 2288-77 amp, which I built from an AL-1500. The 8877 typically wants about 60 watts of drive per tube for full output. And by the way, the cathode of handles, according to the IMAX spec sheet, is 50 ohms. So when you put two tubes in parallel, you get 25 ohms. I'm a little bit short on drive. I've got about 110 watts of drive. And I'm just trying to figure a few things out. Originally, the input said 50 ohms. Mevatron used high network input filters for the input to each band to switch to the cathode. First question, why did they bother to use an input matching network at all when the characteristic impedance of 1-2 is 50 ohms, which translates to 35 or so mils per tube? So I'm trying to get rather light. I would like to get a little more out of it if I could. K2RIW, Detective, Limark, and 2EO.
Very fine, Rich. When it comes to a grounded grid amplifier, and you're driving the Kepler. It's one of the most linear services, but it requires more drive. Had you been grinding the cathode and driving the grid instead, a hell of a lot less power would be required, but it has a little bit less linearity, and it also has the problem of, maybe 10 watts of drive would be required. Most rigs run more like 100 watts or 50 watts of output, so there would be a high probability of overdriving. So, grounded cathode, a grounded grid, and you're driving the cathode, beautiful service. And that particular tube, 8877, very close to 50 ohms of input, you would still use an input tuning network on the cathode for a bunch of reasons. One, by way of the inductor that's part of that tuning network and the bypass capacitors that you can use with it, you could, if you want to, bias the cathode up above ground as far as DC voltage is concerned. Whether you let the cathode go positive or drive the grid negative, in either case, you're adjusting negative control grid voltage, control grid bias. And you adjust that until you get the manufacturer of the tube has a recommended quiescent current that gives you a certain amount of power output with a certain amount of linearity. There's a bunch of compromises there. But for traditional reasons, there's always a tuning network on the input to be sure that the frequency you're using as the output and the frequency using as the input are clearly defined. You don't want to be using the tube as a doubler by mistake. In other words, you may have selected 40 meters for the rig as an output on the afterburner, your high power amplifier. You may have selected 40 meters. You may have forgotten that your driver is on 80 meters. And if you drove it on 80 meters, it'd have about one third or one quarter of the power output. The linearity would be terrible. You'd be using the rig as a frequency doubler. So if there wasn't a tuning network on the input, and because it's a 50 ohm input for one tube, your 80 meter output from your rig, the rig would be perfectly happy. It would think everything's hunky-dory, your main exciter, but the final would give you some pretty weird results, and it would be kind of hard to figure out what's going on. Whereas when you've got a real tuning network, and you select 40 meters, and you use 80 meters on your exciter, the exciter will say, gee, I'm seeing an open circuit. It'll look like an extremely high standing wave ratio. No drive will get there, and you'll know real fast to apply corrective action. Because the FCC has some rather strict controls on high power amplifiers for undesired harmonic output, I believe it's 60 decibels down. The easiest way to make sure that undesired harmonics are 60 dB down is to be sure there's enough high Q tuning in the plate tank circuit, as well as tuning on the input to be sure that only the right frequency is present. You could also make the opposite mistake of driving it on 20 meters when the amplifier is set for 40. So I can see there's a bunch of reasons there. So don't fret about the fact that even though it's 50 ohms in, why are they bothering to use a Pi network? By the way, a Pi network is perfectly happy giving you any impedance ratio you want. You could make you could use a Pi network, and by the way you set the tuning capacitor, which is usually the C1, or the loading capacitor, which is usually the C2, and the L in between, when you set those three parameters, you could make it a step up in impedance, a step down in impedance, or a no step in impedance at all. So your tube itself in your exciter stage maybe has 1,000 ohm impedance, and it has no trouble with the properly designed Pi network, giving you a Q of 10 or
TOS, lockup detect.
Giving you a Q of 10 or greater, and giving you a 50 ohm output from a 1,000 ohm input tube, or vice versa. Now, in your particular case, you'd like to keep that tuning network, but you'd like the tuning network to work a little bit better. Because the original tuning network in the cathode circuit was made for 50 ohms in and out, which really means that your C1 and C2 were equal to each other, or darn close. And now that you've got two tubes in parallel, the simple solution to that is to make the output capacitor of the Pi network, if it's a Pi network,
node number 4478, link clear,
a smaller number of ohms of reactance, in other words, a bigger capacitor. If you increase the value of C2 of the Pi network that's in your cathode and decrease the value of C1 or decrease the value of the inductor, you'll eventually get to the ratio where the rig is exactly tuned to the frequency you care about, and it has 50 ohms in, 25 ohms out. If you didn't do that, and therefore your exciter is seeing a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio,
an error has occurred.
2-to-1.
TOS lockup detect.
2-to-1 standing wave ratio is not very bad for most rigs. As long as your particular exciter can tolerate 2-to-1 without going into a cutback in power, that's not too bad. There's other ways, by way of the Smith-Chart lectures that were given to you by Mel, there's a whole lot of ways that you can use a stub tuner, in other words, a piece of coax cable that goes in between your exciter and your high-power amplifier by choosing the right...
An error has occurred.
By choosing...
TOS lockup detect.
By choosing the right length of that particular piece of cable, of the right impedance, automatically you get the right impedance match on at least one band at a time, if not one band and the third harmonic of those bands. That's one approach. Another approach is at the right location in that coax cable between your exciter and the final, you put a stub off to one side with a T-connector and a length of cable into a shorter and open. And again, it will force the impedance match to be perfect. So, you've got about four choices here. You've got too many choices, and it's going to be hard to choose the right one. So by way of the coax cable that goes between your exciter and your final, you can make the impedance match perfect, even though you've got two tubes. Or you can change the Pi network itself. I think that's most of what you were discussing, and by way of the discussions that you and Mel are going to have, I'll bet you the Smith-Chart approach, with or without sub-tuning, you'll eventually make that amplifier happy. And by the way, once you improve the impedance match between your exciter and your final, you will have more drive than you have now, and that may make up the difference. So the 2-to-1 Vizwire you've got right now is losing you only half a dB, but maybe that's a half a dB of extra drive you'd like to have. M2EO, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Comment to K2K.
Okay, stand by, Rich. Mel, go right ahead.
Okay, very good. This is K2KY. All right, first of all, as far as the input network, I've had experience, of course, with the exact situation that he's dealing with. The input network is very important to work correctly, because I have seen that without that input network, they have used a number of the amplifiers, I won't mention the names of these, to sort of somewhat cheat the product, eliminate that switch assembly, to switch the different bands to the input network. What they did is they used that, like Rich had mentioned, a pile of resistors, and that was supposedly to protect the tuned input from the exciter. So, but what has happened in all those cases where they use that particular, so-called simpler type of input network, the distortion products are definitely more pronounced. To put that input network back together correctly, to make the right input network, it's not very hard, because as you just said, you can do it by the method you just outlined. Or if you want to stay with the multi-band input network, what you have to do is, I know that they publish the queue of what is desired in each one of those networks. I may have the list, but I went through that, and basically the input network consists of a capacitor, so a small toroidal inductor, and another capacitor. It's a very simple network, and to change it around is not really a big deal. Mostly, I think you can get away with maybe even leaving the inductors that the two networks alone, just changing the capacitor in there, the value of the capacitor. But I have to emphasize that you must use a good working input network to provide you with minimum distortion products. This I can tell you for sure, especially on an amplifier, a high-powered amplifier like that.
Okay, Yeah, I highly agree with that. Any kind of a high power amplifier that doesn't have a tuning on the input, making sure that just the right frequency is there, and a tuning on the output, whether you call it impedance match, a Q multiplier, whether you call it a bandpass filter, it doesn't matter. There should be frequency restriction on in and out. So obviously you're not going to eliminate the input tuning network. You've got lots of choices on the input tuning network. High is just one of them. The latest issue of QST Magazine has got a beautiful article on L networks, a single inductor and a single capacitor. And whether you put the inductor first or the capacitor first of an LC network, you can, there's four different ways you can hook it up, and you can make all kinds of higher and lower impedances, and you can correct reactances of the load at the same time. Your input loading of those tubes, it may be 50 ohms, rich on the resistive component. Absolutely positively, I guarantee that those cathodes of those 8877 tubes have a significant amount of capacitance and picofarads to ground, to the grid, whatever. It's not a pure 50-ohm load. It's a highly reactive load. In other words, it's got quite a bit of a capacitor reactance there, as well as a 50-ohm resistive component, one single tube. So for a bunch of reasons, you're going to use a tuning network, and you've now got at least four choices. It could be an L network, it could be a Pi network, or it could be exactly what it is, and you put some kind of a impedance adjusting thing in the coax cable between the exciter and the final. And it's going to be an interesting piece of science to study this one, Rich, decide which is the best way to do it. If you're only using the amplifier on one band, the choice would be quite easy. If you want to make sure you've got the use of the amplifier on all bands, life gets a little bit more complicated, but I guarantee there's a solution. M2EO, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, Dick, K2RIW, TechNet on launch, M2EO. Well, I've got Pi networks, separate Pi networks in there now, for each band. The SWR between the exciter and the amplifier is close to 1-to-1, so I have a good impedance match. My question was, I guess maybe I didn't word it right, but is it possible to get an impedance match with more loss or less loss? See, I'm trying to get an impedance match with the least amount of loss because I'm a little bit shy on drive. You follow me?
I sure do. And I'm amazed that when you went from one tube to two tubes, you didn't go from a 1-to-1 input visoir to a 2-to-1 input visoir. That's a little bit of a mystery. However, I'm not positive, but I think on grounded grid service, particularly what happened on Class C, but I'm pretty sure you're running Class A, I'd like to believe that as you go up or down in drive, the input impedance you see on the cathode stays almost the same. In Class C, it changes radically. You drive a Class C amplifier harder, and the impedance goes down. In the case of linear service, I think that does not take place. Now, you're concerned about the insertion loss of the matching network, that if you could lower the insertion loss, the current amount of drive would be enough. In my opinion, Rich, the chances of that are very slim, and I'll tell you why. You've got 50 or 60 watts of drive right now. And that amplifier, I know, has got enough hair on its chest. You've got enough cooling capability there, blowers and whatever. Into a dummy load, you could run a big dummy load. You could run that amplifier key down for 10 minutes if you wanted to. If that input network was dissipating, let me pick a number, 5 watts out of 60, 5 watts of dissipation key down for a couple of minutes, something in there would be so hot, it would most likely give off a smell. You turn up the amplifier real fast, you touch things, you know it. One of the well-hidden secrets of anything in the RF world that has insertion loss, there's only one way it truly has insertion loss. It takes some of the valuable RF energy and turns it into heat. That's the only way you can get lost. Yeah, you can get lost if it radiates, but I guarantee that your input network is reasonably well shielded inside of a cabinet that's got a closed chunk of steel around it or aluminum around it so it doesn't radiate into the world and so that you can't touch it by mistake and disturb things, so to speak. So If it doesn't radiate, and if it doesn't reflect it back to the exciter, and you'd know that right away by standing wave ratio measurements, the only thing it can do with the power you're giving to it is pass it on to the final amplifier or burn it up into heat, and heat you'd find out real fast. So I doubt it highly. I'm a little bit surprised that your exciter only puts out 60 watts, Rich. Most exciters put out more than that. You know, most exciters that people use these days are in the 100 watt category. So give us a couple of words on how did you go from one tube, which gave you a good visua, to two tubes, and you still have a one-to-one. How did you do that, or did you make modifications to that input matching network as you added the second tube? N2EO, H-U-L-I-W.
Okay, Dick, H-U-L-I-W. Yes, when I added the second tube, I think total was 21 SWR between the exciter and the amplifier. I fiddled around with some of the values of the capacitors. Not very scientific. On the output circuit, Pi network, it was a lot more, scientific about it. I used an MFG analyzer, as I told you, with a resistor load to simulate place heat. I was a lot more scientific about it. On the input network, I just cut and tried different capacitors and two input coils until I got it down to one-to-one. The rig is a Temtec Orion 2, which puts out about 110 watts. But those 8877s want to see about 60 watts to 70 watts per tube. So you can see I'm a little bit shy on drive.
Yes, I definitely do. And now I'm catching on, and you've done all the right things. You adjusted those values on the input circuit, so you got a good standing wave ratio. And on the assumption you can use very lossy components, you did the right thing. To make an input L or Pi network lossy without using a resistor and without using 30-gauge wire and without using capacitors that have got carbon granules built inside of them, you know what I mean, without doing those really yucky things, it's hard to make insertion loss. You don't have any substantial insertion loss on the input network. Even though you think so and you're worried about it, very, very unlikely in my opinion. Now, I guess your next step is to figure out, in order to get full blast power out of that amplifier, how can you get 120 or 140 watts out of your exciter? In single sideband service, where the duty factor is low and you're not running radio teletype or WSJ modes, you know, weak signal Joe Taylor type modes, which are very high duty factor modes, if it's only pure audio that is not highly speech compressed, most amplifiers you can boost the power output by raising screen voltage, raising plate voltage, or whatever on the exciter. Most exciters can easily give you another 20 or 30% more power as long as you're absolutely double darn sure you're only using it in sideband service. And you're a guy who doesn't sit there saying, into the microphone for 10 solid minutes. You're using normal speech, and normal speech has a 20, 22, I think it is, decibel crest factor. That means the peak envelope power of my speech, not Mel's speech, Mel's a softer speaker, but the peak envelope power of my speech versus the average power, the 22 dB of difference. If the average power that creates heating of your tube and final stage of that exciter, and the peak envelope power, as long as it's only there for a brief period of time, the amplifier can handle that very nicely. So I know you like that Orion. You don't want to give it up, and I wouldn't either. I guarantee there are ways you can boost its power output, Rich. Thank you for a comment on that one. K2LIW.
Okay, Dick. Well, I did contact Temtec about that. They told me where the adjustment was for the power, but they recommended I not go above 110 watts. They told me to set it up on 20 meters with a bird wattmeter, key it down and bring it up to 110 watts. But the tech I spoke to, which, unlike a lot of companies, tend to, you actually get to speak to somebody who works on this stuff. But I spoke to a guy who does nothing but the Orion 2s, and he told me not to go above 110 watts. That's what I did, Jake.
Okay, I hear you. and you'd like to have a little more steam than that. And now, do you build an intermediate amplifier? You'd be very tempted to put in a brick amplifier in between. I strongly recommend you do not do that. A high percentage of those brick amplifiers have some huge solid-state amplifiers, have some huge linearity problems. They flat type like crazy. I've seen beyond many guys use them on 2 meters and 450. So, and some of the moonbounce guys are doing it, as long as they're sending more code, no problem. But when they send sideband, there's a number of guys out there with a brick amplifier between their exciter and their high-power final, and their sideband mode, they sound pretty splattery. So, and there's no way you can make the gain of your 8877s any higher. If this is the best of all worlds, and if Bill Orr was working at iMac, or if Bill Eichel was working there, maybe he could select for you a pair of really hot tubes that don't need as much drive. But you don't have that option. And those tubes are what? $500 a piece, some ridiculous number. And they don't have to be matched anyway when they're running in parallel like that. Okay, so good luck with your quest to find more power. More power to you, Rich. And by the way, what we're doing right now, Rich, as you know, because you're a bit of a scientist and you want to get the last little bit of performance out of that amplifier, it's truly academic. If you had 140 watts of drive instead of 110 watts of drive out of your exciter, for instance, the decibel difference is so small when a guy is watching his S-meter as a DX contact, he's never going to know the difference. The fact that you're using an afterburner and you're running a 1,500 watts peak envelope power versus 110, that's huge. He's going to see that. That's going to bring you above the crowd. That's going to bring you above the rabble, and you're going to get through during a pileup. But if you're putting out 1,300 watts versus 1,500 watts peak envelope power, except for laboratory instrumentation, nobody's going to know the difference. So how hard you work to get that last little bit of performance is your choice, and it's an interesting hobby, but it's not. It shouldn't be on the top of your priority list, in my opinion. Now, other people have got other opinions on that. I'm going to move on, and if we got some time left over, we'll come back and talk about this some more, Rich. Now, Mr. QGZ, you and I have got to get together. I got some stuff for you. You got some stuff for me. And you got questions for the group. One of the more interesting guys to talk to. WB2QGZ, AQRIW. You got it, Bill.
Hey, good evening. Not as much sort of a question. Just wondering, and I don't want to steal Barry's thunder. He was going to talk about this later during space time. Just wondering if you were aware of the 40-meter moonbounce experiment on the weekend, and if you or anybody listened, and what anyone happened to think. Okay.
Welcome to the W2EL repeater.
40-meter moonbounce. Now, I've heard of moonbounce. The very first moonbounce by Ham was done on 1296, and it was iMac and, I can't think of his name, the guy from Swampscott, Sam Harris, W1FZJ, I think it was, who eventually went down to Arecibo, Puerto Rico. 1296 was the first ham radio off the moon. The first off-the-moon signal officially done by the military was done at 420 megacycles with a radar at Fort Monmouth, New Jersey. So, and now hams have done it almost on every band. I think it's been done on 22 gigs, certainly on 10. I believe it's been done on 5, 3, 2, 1, 432. I don't think anyone's done moonbounce on 900 megs, if for no other reason than European amateurs do not have a 900 meg band. Only North and South America has it. So I don't know if 900 meg has been used. 220 certainly has. 2 meters, 6 meters. I think 10 meters has been used for moonbounce. 40 meters. I got some idea for what that antenna would look like. No, I haven't heard about it. I'd like you to give us at least a paragraph on this one, Bill. How did you find out about it? I don't think it was the QST, although I haven't read it carefully cover to cover. I haven't been reading my moonbounce. I haven't been reading my all of my emails that I've been getting lately. I've been involved in a higher priority project, which I'll eventually be telling you about. So tell us a little bit about 40 meters. Who's doing it? I know that Stanford University has tried things like that. In fact, they bounced a signal off the sun. with 28 megacycles and an acre and a half of antennas, literally. Who did it? What did they do? How much power? How big is the antenna? And I'm guessing the antenna is huge. So give us some words on this one, Bill. WB2QGZ, K2LAW in the tech net.
The short story is the HARP array, or High Went Altitude Auroral Research Project array in Alaska, which normally just kind of blasts the ionosphere at the zenith over there, was used to transmit on 69, 72.5, just above 7 meg. Apparently it did this successfully once before, out of the handband. To talk to the VLA, or Very Large Array, in, I think, Mexico. And they were able to phase the antenna off of zenith and towards the moon, where the moon happened to be a perigee. And it was a good spot for the antenna, good spot for the moon, good spot for the moon to be close. And for two evenings, they illuminated the moon. They would transmit for 2 seconds, and then they would pause for 2 seconds, 3 seconds, and listen for the echo in New Mexico. And anybody who was listening, I guess depending on where you were and what your antenna was like, you'd hear either sky wave, lunar reflection, neither or both. And I heard both here and there. Heard the sky wave a couple times with no reflection. Never heard reflection without sky wave, but it was kind of interesting. Both signals were in the noise by me. One of them was perceptibly weaker. If I had any S meter reading, it was S3 versus S2 in the noise. But that was the story, okay?
Sensing to IGZ recognized. Bill, how did you find out about this? And what kind of an antenna were you using, or what kind of equipment were you using? Bill first, go ahead.
It was in, I first saw it actually in the AMRAD club in Virginia has a mailing list. It was on their mailing list, and they referenced the ARL website. I saw it later, a couple days later, in the ARL letter, I believe, which comes out from the league by email. And I did see something when I happened to go over to QRZ.com to look somebody up. I did see something on that open page referring back to the ARL page, and that's where I found out about it. Antenna system was relatively small, G5RB, about 30 feet off the ground, oriented with the ends east and west. And receiver was a TS-440, with about a 500 kc IF filter selected. That was it. Good.
WS2N recognized. You said 500 kc filter. I bet you meant 500 hertz filter. Okay, we got IGZ and WS2N in that order. Mr. IGZ, give us your full call letters and your name, and go ahead with your question or comment first. Go ahead. My name is Dick.
Okay, with Alpha 2, Italy, Alpha Delta, and the name is Chuck, Charlie, and question. But what I'm listening to is not the content, but it just seems like every 5 seconds the power shuts down and then backs up. I don't know what it is, but that.
Okay. First of all, Chuck, your audio is extremely low. You're 10 dB below everyone else's audio. So your mic gain is set very low. But something is going on that your deviation is very low. I think you're telling me that when it comes to the power coming out of 146.85, the repeater in Glen Oaks, Long Island, on the Nassau-Queens border, I'm looking at that power output on my S-meter, and it is not moving. So if your S-meter is going up and down, something local to you may be creating a change in your receiver. That's my best guess there, Chuck. Maybe I misinterpreted you. I think you're saying that the power is going up and down that you see on your S meter. And out here in Huntington, I'm not seeing that. Back to you for a quick comment on that, Chuck. And Chuck, you're going to have to shout into that microphone. Your audio is very low.
Okay, I just moved the power here a bit. I hope that's better. And I'm out here in Brentwood, so we're not that terrible far. But it just seems like on the receiving end, that describes exactly what I'm hearing. I don't know if it's mine or the repeater, but every 5 seconds, the power from the repeater just shuts down. So I'm just going to give a quick count to see if I shut down. 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5. Back to you, WXYG.
Dave, the radio with priority scan.
Okay, the your power output, I'm listening to you on the input, you didn't change. The repeater power output, it didn't change. There is a mode change going on periodically where you hear the audio amplitude going up and down because of the echo link experiments that are taking place. You hear some announcements taking place. Now, maybe, Bill, did you just say something about this effect, maybe? If that was you, Bill, go ahead.
Yeah, I just wonder if the radio's in priority search or scan, and that's why it's dropping every 5 seconds when it's sampling another channel.
Okay, yeah. Well, there's a lot of people listening to this repeater right now, Chuck, and we're not hearing any change in power output. Change in audio amplitude a little bit, yes, but... So, the programming of your radio or some local signal... There are radios where, in the so-called priority scan, periodically it'll go and look to see if another signal is present on the priority channel, although usually that's only a fraction of a second look, as I remember. Although if it finds something, yes, it'll dwell there. But, and if there's a very strong local signal to you that could be creating front-end blocking, I've seen that effect where you think the signal you're listening to is going up and down, in reality your receiver is being overloaded by something that is close by in frequency and very strong. That's my guess there. Let's see what Paul's got to say about this EME thing. So you found out about it from the ARL letter, which I should have read and couldn't. The AMRAD Virginia listserv, and by the way, Socorro, New Mexico, is where that great big, very large array is located. It's part of the National Radio Astronomy Observatory, and whenever you visit them at Green Bank, West Virginia, you go into their visitor center, you'll be able to, if you desire, to purchase some very large pictures, wall charts and whatever, of the very large array. The very large array is not only one of the really big radio telescopes in the world, but periodically it is also used for very long baseline interferometry. In other words, they combine the signal from it with a bunch of other radio telescope facilities in other places in the world, and they all look at the exact same star, nebula, or whatever at the same time and combine the signals. And they get a much higher resolution picture and a much higher signal-to-noise ratio when they do that. And if they're doing a SETI search that way, whoa, boy, would they make Jodie Foster happy from the movie Contact. What do they call her? Mrs. Arroway, I think was her name. Okay, Paul, WS2N, go right ahead with your question or comment. KQRW in the TechNet.
Oh, yeah, Ellie Arroway. Dick, I was just wondering if Bill heard, did he hear CW signals and what type of signals, what did they send? Did they send a pop or, what did they send in their CW message? And I saw the email from the ARRL, and that's where I read about it. I think it was, 1 o'clock in the morning, either last night or the night before. One of them was on a half hour. But I didn't get a chance to do it. I was just curious, what Bill heard. And I understand, according to the email, you send it to your reports, and they're looking for reports from hands. I think that's how it sort of wound up on the ARRL site. They were actually looking for reports. The Bill could send us reported. Back to you, Dick.
And I bet you Bill was wishing he had one of those Spectran programs built into his computer looking at the output from his particular receiver. the Spectran type things that the guys who are using WSJT and weak signal Joe Taylor techniques allow you to see signals that are very far below the noise. You see there's a stripe of noise across the screen, vertically displaced, which lets you know right away that some signal is coming up out of the mud, so to speak. How did you know, Bill, the difference between the, what would you call it now, terrestrial propagation versus the extraterrestrial propagation? Time delay of 2.5 seconds is one big factor. Was there a simple on-off keying just to prove how strong the signal was, or was there a real Morse code message? Tell us a little bit more about this one, Bill. WV2QGZ, T2LAW.
Yep, first order business, you're right about the filter. You know, sometimes it works. 500 kilohertz is a small filter, but you have the 500 cycle, 500 hertz correction. Yeah, 500 hertz now is the other filter. And all it was a CW carrier. It was up for 2 seconds, then they dropped that, and then 2 seconds of that, then you should get the reflection, whether it's basically the reflection. Then another 2 seconds of signal, and then it's about a 5 second cycle, I think, and about a, you know, half second each guard time in the center. So it was just cycling, you know, the harp array would transmit and then shut down, and then the channel would be clear for the echo, and then they'd retransmit from the harp array again. When it came up, it was timed very closely. In other words, the time was published ahead of time. You knew it was starting up. I think the first night was 0500 UTC. The second night was 0630 UTC. And it starts off right at the top of the hour for 2 seconds, then pauses for 2 seconds. And they published the duty cycle of the transmitter, which followed UTC exactly. So in other words, I could use my GPS reference time or my WWBB reference time to see where we were. And it was kind of obvious because you would hear a stronger carrier and then a weaker carrier, then the stronger carrier again at times. And that kind of made it almost foolproof for me, I think. I think I got all the questions.
Yeah, at 40 meters, close to 7 megacycles, my guess is there's very little Doppler shift. The guys who operate 10 gigs off the moon hear a huge amount of Doppler spread and Doppler shift. And I'll explain those two. The so-called vibration fading, in other words, because you're on the surface of the Earth and the Earth is rotating, even if the moon is directly overhead to you, you are moving, the equator is progressing from west toward east, so to speak, so you're moving close to 1,000 miles an hour from west toward east when you stand on the equator. That means that the left side of the moon appears to be coming toward you and the right side of the moon appears to be receding from you. Because of the parallax effect, they call it vibration fading. And so the left side of the moon is going to give you a positive Doppler shift, and the right side of the moon is going to give you a negative Doppler shift. When you're up at 10,000 megacycles, that Doppler shift is a significant number of hertz, tens of hertz, even kilohertz, and you can hear it. And if the Doppler spread, the signal starts sounding like a aurora noise, even though it's a pure CW tone you're sending. You get down to a frequency of 7 megacycles instead of 10,000, let me think now, probably 1,200 times a lower ring frequency, that means the Doppler shift is going to be 1,200 times lower, and you're almost not going to hear it. So my guess is you heard no Doppler, although when you're hearing terrestrial and moon simultaneously, I think you would be hearing cyclic fading, cyclic QFB. Did you make a tape recording of it, Bill? If so, can you play us a tape recording? WB2QGZ, kind of curious why you get such a delay. K2LAW in the TechNet, coming back to us.
This is the W2UL repeater. The time is 8:47 p.m.
Oh, not being intimately familiar with the how this thing is set up for the NAT anymore. Time out or otherwise foul up the IRLP or whatever it was. I do have an acoustical recording I made. Primarily because I just wanted to show my daughter real quick, so it's kind of a quick and dirty thing. I definitely got to clean it up because it contains another you know, some other stuff around the room here. I was just going to, I burned about 15 minutes of it. Was going to try to pick out a good short section. So when I do that, I can package it up and come back, or I can shoot it to you as a, you know, an email attachment, a short audio file, something like that. And, you know, one of the other things I was thinking about trying to do here, and time just didn't cooperate between Friday and Saturday, is I was going to try to take, I have it in one of my pieces of test equipment for work. I have similar to a WSJT display. You know, we refer to it as a waterfall display. We use it for some interference detection for some stuff at work. And I was going to try to see if I could couple that into the IF output of the radio here and sample the IF just to see what it looked like, both spectrally, because they were up for about 2 hours both nights. Just look around spectrally and also with the waterfall display. But, you know, unfortunately, time just didn't cooperate during the day. Okay.
Yeah, I wasn't asking you to ship a recording to me, Bill. I was asking you to just take 15 seconds worth of it and play it over the air to us now. Guaranteed that people here are curious as to what you heard. Second of all, we amateurs get impressed when we hear great big transmitter power output. So do you happen to know the Hawk transmitter? How many kilowatts of power were they running? How big was the antenna? Do you happen to know any of those pieces of information? Back to you, Bill.
Okay, I know where it's going with the tape is I definitely have to find a piece in there that's clean, that has clean audio, that has both skywave and reflection signals. So it would certainly take me a little bit to get that together. So it's possible if I have that available and folks are still interested next week, I can give that a shot. Transmitter power also, you know, there is some information available on the first test and the second test. I'm sure there'll be a little bit of a follow-up on the second test. The webpage hasn't been updated yet. But if you were to web search for HARP, H-A-A-R-P, I'm sure you would get up to that, or, you know, HARP moon bounce experiment or whatever in Google, you could come up with a page. And there is some information there, specifics on the transmitter and everything. I believe it was 3.7 megawatt CRP. That was the number that stuck in my head for the transmit signal, right?
Okay, that was the effective radiated power. Any idea how big the antenna was, Bill? And no delay is required. You can come right back to us.
Yep, gotcha. It's pretty big. If you go up to the webpage, there's a number of pictures of it. Physical size, I don't remember. It's interesting that they go into detail on the webpage that it's not a weather-controlling device and all sorts of other stuff. There is a lot of, I guess, folklore about what it actually does. The construction's pretty interesting, too, the way they have elements mounted above a mesh screen that you can drive underneath to get to the actual transmitter buildings, which are all phased into the array. So that in and of itself is a pretty cool thing to look at and troll around on their website.
Yeah, but the whole purpose, I think, of the Hawk experiment is to artificially heat the ionosphere with RF energy, so that even when the sunspot cycle is low and you don't have much of an ionosphere, you squirt enough RF energy into it, you create your own ionosphere. And so, if I wanted to communicate from, let's say, New York to Japan, and if the HARP location was midway between the two, and they turn on their transmitter, create an artificial artificial ionosphere, all of a sudden, I've got a path and I can communicate. Obviously, it has a lot of military application because there's some times when you've got very hostile land where you can't install radio equipment, but you've got to bridge that hostile land in order to communicate with your troops, for instance. So that's what I think is going on. Was it a bunch of dipoles above this screen that you remember, and a couple of acres worth of them, and so they maybe put 50 kilowatts of power into it? The rest of it is the effective radiated power coming from the antenna gain. That's where the multi-megawatts is coming from. That's approximately it. Bill, go ahead.
That sounds like about it. I don't recall whether they were dipoles or cross dipoles and fed in some way, but yeah, it was pretty much to illuminate directly above. And it was, judging from the picture I remember, it's some number of acres, yeah, would be a fair estimate.
Did you hear any slow Doppler or slow QSB during the time the key was down. Let's see, the key was down for 2 seconds. So if you had two or three QSBs in there in the 2 seconds, you would see it. And I was starting to explain that earlier. Doppler spread comes from apparent libration fading. In other words, the left and right side of the moon seems to rock back and forth compared to an Earth-bound observer. Also, the moon's orbit around the Earth is elliptical. So except for when the moon is at apogee or perigee, it is always slightly changing in range to us. Therefore, the echo to the moon and back is going to have a path that's either growing or shrinking, and therefore that signal, by way of moon bounce, has a continuous phase shift compared to the terrestrial signal, and therefore you would hear some QSB to that. You would see the signal going up and down, very similar to what you get when you're listening to a Oscar satellite that's tumbling, and you're using a linear polarized antenna, and you hear a QSB fade on each rotation, or each half rotation. So, did you hear anything there, Bill, that you think would now, when you go back to it, that sounded like a slow or fast QSB fade? Back to you, Bill.
Okay, I kind of had two different types of fades. One of them was a very long fade, and it affected both the sky wave and the lunar reflection. In other words, where I get a couple seconds or a couple of cycles where the signal would get weaker, I would lose it for a little bit, and then it would come back. As I mentioned earlier, I did have, in order to a period of time when I heard sky wave only and no lunar reflection, there was a period of time when I heard neither. There was never an instance, just the way it worked out in my 20 to 30 minutes of listening, where I heard what seemed like a lunar reflection by itself. Both signals did have that slow fade, and they were not in sync, if you want to call it that. In other words, there were times when the sky wave would fade in a long fade. There was times when the lunar echo would fade in a long fade, then come back in amplitude to the max of each. Again, not necessarily in phase. There could have been a relatively quick fade in the center of the 2 seconds. I say yes. The signal was very weak to me, but yeah, it's quite possible that it could have taken a quick hit during the actual reflection time. I believe so.
Very good. During the time you were listening, was there any QR Mary or QR Nancy, or was that channel reasonably clean, and all you heard was a very weak signal and noise? Back to you, Bill. No delay required.
Yeah, there was a period of time, I don't know, maybe 5 minutes after the start with the I think it was a tuner-upper. I think he was trying to peak his antenna up by ensuring it transmitted well. Went away pretty quick. That was about it. Otherwise, the channel was very quiet.
A little bit of reading you've done about the HARP system itself. Can they electronically steer the beam out of the HARP to favor the moon's direction? Or is it a fixed beam and you pray that the moon goes through the middle of it? Back to you, Bill.
Okay, they do have the ability, per the website, to move it a little bit off axis so they can phase it a little bit. Or a zenith, actually. It's design point. And I think, you know, the last experiment, I don't know when it happened. I got the impression it was a couple months ago, maybe in October or something like that. I get the impression that they can only move it so far off or phase it so far off the zenith. And it has to be kind of a fortuitous circumstance of moon position, perigee, earth position, you know, the whole geometry working out where they can light it up with sufficient power, you know, based on the position of everybody. Okay.
Did they ever say whether the HARP antenna was used in the receive mode or was it only used in the transmit mode? Question number one. Question number two, you already did tell us that the Socorro, New Mexico, the very large array, was doing receiving. Any word yet as to what the other facilities in the world heard? Back to you, Bill.
No, I hadn't seen anything else. I did submit a report this morning, a signal report. I'm sure they're amassing all of that stuff, and I get the impression. They're pretty forthcoming with information on the website that at some point they'll probably update with what else received. I got the impression that the HARP was transmit only, and that the designated receive point for the experiment which they had done before. You know, one of the things they set up on the website is they believe that the signal should, the reflection should be able to be detected with a, you know, just a 40-meter dipole, or if you had a Yagi, point your Yagi at the moon. But I guess they weren't 100% sure, because the first test they used, the VLA receive. But the primary receive point for this was the VLA antenna.
Hey, Bill, here's a funny question for you. I know the answer. I think I know the answer. How many ham radio operators on planet Earth do you think have a 40-meter Yagi antenna that can be elevated and aimed at the moon? How many do you think there are like that, Bill? Go ahead.
Someday when I'm rich and famous, I'll have one hanging in the backyard. But other than that, I don't think very many. Maybe that one fellow who had the that big old construction project in the Midwest. I don't know if he had it. I don't know if he had elevation adjustment. I believe he did, didn't he? Their point was ornament yourself in the azimuth towards the moon. I don't think they were really considering anybody had elevation control.
Okay, you're talking about K9 Lima Tango November. You would do an email search on that, and you're going to see the biggest ham radio antenna you've ever seen. It consists of 180 feet of Rhone 85 tower. The horizontal boom for his array of 6 Yagis is Rhone 65 tower. And his vertical mast for holding up 3 antennas at a time is a Rhone 45, I think it is, or 55. And those are step IR antennas, which certainly cover 40 meters. Wait a minute now. The step IR, I think, goes from 20 meters through 6 meters, to my knowledge. He was going to put one in the middle at a later time, which was going to be a 40 step IR, one single antenna. And let me think now. I'm looking at the way that thing elevates. The Rhone 65 horizontal mast, boom, the horizontal mast is the one that elevates, and the 40-meter step IR was going to be mounted on the vertical mast coming out of the tower. I think that one does not elevate. So although there's a guy with a great big Yagi on 40 meters, I think he cannot elevate it. So there may be not one single ham on planet Earth that can do that. Sounds like a fun experiment. Awful glad you brought that to our attention, Bill. Boy, I've been in the dark on this one. Didn't even see this one coming. And thank you for bringing it to our attention. I'm going to move on to Mike before we put him to sleep. N2MOC, I think it is. Mike Oscar Charlie. I think you had a question. I go right ahead, Mike. K2LIW on the TechNet. My name is Dick.
K2JJ with a quick question.
Go ahead, Doug.
Hey, evening, Dick. Just a quick comment. If you check your email, I sent you a JPEG of the HARP array.
Okay, that sounds good. I thank you for that. Mike, are you still there? Into MOC, go right ahead.
I'm listening, but I'm listening. There's no question.
Very fine, Mike. Okay, Luke said no. K2KNB, Rich, our president, said he's just listening. I mean, tell me, you've gone down the list already. Is there anybody out there we've skipped by mistake? Give me a call, let us right now.
K2GOT, no question.
Okay, Mr. GOT with no question. Okay. Maybe we're going to go over to the space report with Paul without keeping him up too late tonight. And so what's going on with NASA, Paul? WS2N. K2RIW in effect, man.
Oh, okay, Dick. I just wanted to mention the STS-122, which will be bringing the Columbus Module up to the...